Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, Text 5. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Nara uvacha bhikshubir vipravashite bhikshubir vipravashite vijana deshtribir. Wait, what is it? Nara uvacha bhikshubir vipravashite vijana deshtribir mama vartamano vayasyadye Tita eta akarisham. Sri Narada said, the great sages who had imparted scientific knowledge of transcendence to me departed to other places, and I had to pass my life in this way. Purport, in his previous life, when Naradaji was impregnated with spiritual knowledge by the grace of the great sages, there was a tangible change in his life. Even though he was only a boy of 5 years, this is an important symptom visible after initiation by a bona fide spiritual master. Actual association of devotees brings about a quick change in life for spiritual realization. How it is so acted upon the previous life of Sri Narada Muni is described by and by in this chapter. Om Jnanati Marandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Daksur Unmavitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Tapitam yena bhutale sayam rupa kadamayam tadati svapadantikam vansha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa shindu bhayebhya patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from the Sun Falls, Iverson Falls. I love when I have a rare week free. And my life is just completely organized on me. But not me, on Krishna, but on me in the sense of taking care of my needs. Both in my studies, in my chanting, in my health. Anyway, it's a wonderful place by the grace of Sachi Sutta and Kali Lalita, which is a shelter for many Vaishnavas. Satsrup Maharaj and Baladeva there across the street, Mother Kalini's next door, and all the people that visit her. So this is such a nice place I have here. And a nice neighborhood with people who are really affected by the devotees. I've never seen a neighborhood where the outside is so influenced by the devotees in so many ways. It's really amazing. Even when I go to the supermarket, sometimes some lady that you would never expect, you know how they are, kind of country folk, kind of overweight leotard types. And they come up to me and they say, "Bill, so nice to see you." Of course, they're talking about Baladev. Kind of somehow all devotees look the same to them. But wherever he goes, wherever business he does, a lady was from the Social Security office or the medical, or he cooks prasad. Everyone in this neighborhood has prasad. I mean, from trays of lasagna to cookies, mostly cookies. People on the block, they can get a tray of lasagna. Or there's even one biker. His name is Jody. They call him Jotir. Jyoti. They call him Jyoti. Yeah, I mean, he's so conditioned. The only vegetarian food he can eat is macaroni and cheese, and Baladev makes that for him. But you can just see the effects of devotees. I told you, even the Girl Scouts in this neighborhood went to Vrindavan. There's so many people, you can't even tell sometimes who is a devotee and who is not, because people are just so friendly and they have so much appreciation. Well, to speak that within 15 minutes of my house, there's three major yoga studios all connected with the devotees and all successful. And one is a very beautiful spa called Bodhi Spa. And they're beautiful, full-size Gornitai deities. One is called Bodhi Spa, one is called Sadhana, and one is called Govinda Yoga, and they're all successful. And Raghunath, just with the help of Sachi Sutta here, who's a great benefactor of Vaishnavas, has purchased a beautiful piece of land, which I went to see. Beautiful, on 10 acres with a stream that has a building that will have a retreat center for 20 people. I think it's called the Super Soul Center for Living or something like that. So that will also be there with that. So many, just many ways and many nice devotees. And Gopriya has a school in Hudson, the town of Hudson, which is really cool. They call it the Chelsea of upstate New York. Chelsea, New York. And she has a school and so many respectable people coming. So that way there's so much interaction. I see in my own, because I see the burgeoning effect of Krishna consciousness, and I've been kind of, you know, hitting the pavement here in New York for, you know, 20, 30 years. And no one was coming. And now seeing how we're having our retreat, our second Bhakti immersion retreat, and without advertising, we are packed to the rafters. I mean, we have every spot. We rented out the whole center, and we have 75 people with presenters. So every single spot is taken. And the center itself, I feel they're devotees. The relationship is not business anymore. It's just they're like our family. They're spiritual people. They're vegetarians. They're open to Krishna consciousness. And really, some really wonderfully, deeply spiritual people, broadly connected to the Theosophical Society. But it's like a holy dham with all that chanting and beautiful river. So it's just so edifying to see. And I know, I was talking with Devamrita Swami, who's a pretty good friend of mine, and he understood that, you know, in terms of my outreach, I'm not parachuting in from outside. I'm a person of another community. I mean, my main community is Prabhupada's mission, but I'm part of something that's much broader than that. And not artificially either. These people can be friends and wonderful people and spiritualists and whatever, and so many other things too. So, you know, even just my old Toyota going to the dealer, you know. It's just so many nice interchanges with the different people who you've been kind of living with for so many years, and they can actually see the character and of the yes, anyway, now we'll go to the Bhagavatam. That was a little introduction of my own personal inspiration, but you know, we're up to the section which is very interesting, where Narada is explaining to Vyas what is the essence of all the Vedas. And the essence of all the Vedas is to transcend the ego. And he's saying the best way to do that is by love of God, not just by neglect of renunciation, but by developing attraction for God. And true love dissolves the ego. And the greatest love is love for the Supreme. That's the greatest love. So one who actually does that, his identity is changed. So he's telling him that, you know, there may be, the Vedas is so vast and there's so much knowledge in the Vedas. Because obviously, to function even for the purpose of developing love of Godhead, you must also take care of so many needs. And if the Vedas is a shastra, a sacred text that's comprehensive, it's dealing with all needs, because, you know, there's a right way to do everything. There's, you know, a way to live, a way to eat, even, you know, social, even military, medical. You know, so there's so much knowledge there. And becoming spiritual for people who are not so spiritual, you know, how do they move forward, you know, society, you know, what if everybody became God conscious? Well, how would you rule things? Yeah, you're so much affected by so many things. And therefore, it's so confusing. And it's sometimes very, very hard to actually comprehend and understand the message. And especially when you have to communicate it. Especially when you have to communicate that message and you don't want anything lost in the translation. And that's what Vyas had to do. And he tried so many things, but he wasn't completely satisfied. And then Narada said, well, because your strategy, people would get lost. You can make so many strategies for spiritual life that people... He says, cut to the chase, cut to the point. You know, the best way is to hear about the glories of Krishna, hear about the glories of God, and become attracted. And become attracted to... So even the Yoga Sutras, A.G. Mohan, who's one of the greatest scholars of the Yoga Sutras, when the Yoga Sutras recommends that it recommends that the best path of meditation is to worship God, chant mantras with devotion, with giving yourself, with surrendering. He said, because unless you're focused on something higher, it's very difficult to give up the ego. Therefore, the process of Jnana, which is just a process of negation, you can just feel, I'm the best negator. I am the best renunciate. And ultimately, if you don't have a conception of God, then you can think, I am God. And what is a greater ego than that? So, therefore, Narada explains to him in no uncertain terms how he should edit the Vedas, and he should describe Krishna. and he described the beautiful pastimes of Krishna. So one can become attracted to serving God and all God's beauty. And this is what bhakti is. Bhakti is love. It's that sense. And it begins with surrender. Surrender to what? Surrender to that flow of truth. Surrender to, you know, the knowledge of reality, which includes God and us as God's servants, and how to achieve that sublime position of being a lover of the divine. So, Narada gives these instructions to Vyas and then begins to illustrate it with his personal story. And there was a little break in the personal story because he was explaining some point. So Narada, and this is a legitimate way of inspiration, you explain a point and you show practically how that point is work. And if it's worked in your own life, then it's very powerful because you can explain it with your own personal conviction. So he's explaining with personal conviction how by this process of hearing the glories of God, hearing about Krishna, by this process he became purified. And his life is an example of someone who goes through all the stages of self-purification. But it begins with the association of saintly people. Because there's no other place where you can get those ideas. And where you can see those ideas so beautifully embodied. Where else can you find, where else will you become inspired? Who has come to spiritual life without meeting a saintly person? How is it possible? Or their teachings in the form of books, which is just the manifestation of their hearts. Otherwise, how to come, how to change? What will inspire? Well, we can become inspired to change, but we won't know how to change. To change, you need a path. And you need confidence in a path. Without confidence, you're not going to go down a path because the path, you know, is fraught with so many obstacles. So here it is. He's the teacher. Now he wants to give the student confidence in the path by describing his own, how it worked for him. And he's not just trying to explain the path for Vyas to traverse, but for Vyas to explain. And that takes super realization, real depth of understanding. So he started to explain, and he explained he was with these great saintly persons. He became very inspired, and he was serving them. And service is a very, very powerful transformatory activity when it's connected to people worthy of service. Because when you serve, and that just doesn't mean obligatory, it means love. And you really want to please, you have to focus on the other person's heart, what that person wants. And if you enter into the heart of a saintly person, you'll see so many beautiful flowers of realization and desire. And when you appreciate those, then they come to your own heart. Sushusro Shradhatanasya Vasudeva Kata Rachis Yat Mahatsevana Vipra Punyat Tirtanishit. That by serving the great souls, then that's such a wonderful thing. And by that comes bhakti. Because what happens is you develop an attraction for hearing. You develop an attraction for hearing. Because that's the symptom of love. When you have love for someone, you want to talk about them and you want to hear about them. So hearing, Shravanam is called in Sanskrit, is the process, is the symptom of love. It's also the process of love. Because bhakti sanjayate bhakti. It's the symptom of love, which is the expression of love, which is the creation of love. So it's so important. So he had the association of saintly people. And then by getting the remnants of their food stuff and becoming so purified. And then they saw his faith, his desire to learn. And therefore, they're willing to teach him. You don't teach someone who doesn't have some level of faith, because they won't, without that faith, they won't try to understand something that's beyond their own preconceived level of understanding. It'll stop there. Without faith, and learning is such a difficult thing. Especially when it's spiritual knowledge and you have to apply it. It's such a difficult thing. So it has to be faith. And faith will be the basis of learning from someone who is worthy of teaching. So it's that faith. Otherwise, you'll see everything through your own limited conception, and you won't go beyond that limited conception. So everything is based on this faith. And when the teacher sees the student has faith, then they can reveal further and further truths beyond that student's personal level of comprehension or analysis or worldview or attachments. So he tells the story, and then he explains a point about this change of hearing, that the way to come to that platform when you're embodied in the world is just to take whatever you have and give it to God. That purifies your vision, it purifies your consciousness, and it develops an attraction for hearing. And not only that, but so it develops an attraction. So he explains that, and then he concludes that God is the object of our love, is so wonderful that working for him will inspire remembrance of him. That it's worthy to work for him. Working for God is spiritual. It's not karmic. You know, I'll be back in just 1 second. Vyas is listening very intently to this, and he says, please, tell me about the story, because it's very interesting. Here you are as this effulgent sage, and previously you were a maidservant, millenniums ago. But yet here you are standing before me, remembering the same things. So how is this fresh in your memory, this subject matter that happened millennia ago? And how did you pass your time after the sages left? Because the last thing that you told me was the sages taught you the Bhagavatam, and then you left. And he said, I had to pass my life. they departed for other places. And obviously he was in separation from them. But he was also responsible because he had to take care of his mother. But here in the purport said is when he heard and he got initiated, there was a tangible change in his life. And change in life comes from commitment. Commitment brings you above your impulses to a platform of judgment, acting on the platform of understanding or acting on the platform of love. So commitment brings you above that platform and therefore changes you. Otherwise, you don't change. If you don't make commitment, you don't change. You just act according to your impulses, which is what we generally are. That we generally act just according to our mind, or that or our mind means our vrittis, our attachments, our aversions. That's who we are. Now, how do we change our attachments or aversions? By commitment. And if commitment is made, then there is change. So this is an important symptom. In a spiritual relationship, there's commitment and there's change. And that commitment is a commitment to a relationship, and it's a commitment to a sangha that will change us. So he said, I changed. I was the only son of my mother, who is not only a simple woman, but a maidservant as well. Since I was her only offspring, she had no other alternative for protection. She bound me with a tie of affection. So her only alternative for protection is she had a son. Otherwise, she was just a simple woman without a husband and a maidservant. And because of that, I was bound by her affection. Ananya Gatau, she had no alternative, you know, as a child for protection. I was her investment. I was her hope. I'd be her life. So she bound me with the tie of affection, which means if someone loves you and is affectionate towards you, and you're a normal person, you will be reciprocal and want to love and care for them. And bound means to be tied by something outside of yourself. So when you're bound by affection, you're bound by the desires and needs of someone which is outside of yourself. You're bound by their needs. I have to take care. It's like the modern life is really kind of cruel because the family breaks apart. It's, you know, even out of love, it's just the way things are constructed. I see my older brother lost his wife, you know, and she was a very good wife, and he was dependent on her. And then, you know, one daughter, I mean, she's living her life. It's the way it is. Not her fault. She goes to Spain because that's where her career brings her. And the other daughter moves into Brooklyn because her career brings her. And they're into their careers and into their life. But the result is he buys up alone. That's the modern kind of life. It doesn't have that kind of family, you know, bound. People are left alone. And she had no other alternative for protection. So she saw me as her protection, and therefore My heart was moved, Narada is saying, which is natural for a person. Your heart is moved. And then you're bound by their needs. Modern world people are not bound. They're not bound. They're bound by affection. 1, 6, 7. She wanted to look after my maintenance properly, but because she was not independent, she was not able to do anything for me. The world is under the full control of the Supreme Lord. If everyone is like a wooden doll in the hands of a puppet. Yoga Shemam. She wanted to maintain me. But Aswatantara, she was not independent. We're not independent. So what can we maintain? We can maintain as much as God allows us. So we're not fully independent. So he's saying, even though my mother had this affection, she couldn't really even maintain me. And it wasn't her fault. She's not independent. She tried her hardest. And therefore, he's making an astute analysis. Everyone is like the wooden doll in the hands of a puppet master. So my mother was moving to maintain me, but someone else was pulling the strings. So she wasn't independent to maintain me. And that's the illusion of the material world. The illusion of the material world is that we are the maintainers and protectors. Or we are the maintainers. We're not. That's the illusion of family life when they describe, you know, that when it's not the modern family life, but previously, or mostly not, of course, there still can be examples, but previous family life, it was functional. And there were bonds, and there's a lot of affection. And therefore, when they talk about the illusion of family life, you're more likely in a situation where everything conforms to your desires. And when that happens, the difficulty is you can not only become attached to that, but develop the misconception that I am the one that's doing it. And therefore not seeing the strings of God, not seeing God, that could be the, what would they, when they talk about the illusion of family life, that's what they're talking about. That the situation works. You're in a situation of a lot of affection and protection and care, and you have to be careful not to forget that actually, just like when it's not maintained or it is maintained, God is still pulling the strings. It's not you. There's five factors of action. One is the endeavor. It's not you. God is pulling the strings. You still think, no, I'm actually doing this because I worked for hard. I worked hard like this. But no, some people work hard and nothing happens. And people lose their jobs or get their jobs. When I was a mere child of 5 years old, I lived in a Brahmin school. I was dependent on my mother's affection, and I had no experience of different lands. So he's very, very sheltered, and he lived in a Brahmin school. And the only thing that was giving him shelter was his mother's affection. And that's what real shelter is. Because the primary need we have is to be loved. So if we don't have those relationships, and especially with God, we're not going to feel sheltered. If our heart is not filled with love, we are not sheltered no matter how much protection, money, power we have. The shelter means where you go to get your needs met. The primary need that we have is for relationship and love. So when we take shelter, when God is the ultimate shelter, yes, he's the maintainer. But what is he really maintaining more than anything else? He's maintaining the core existential basis of our being, which is the need to have an object of love. And to be have an object of love and be the object of that person's love. Once upon a time, my poor mother was going out one night to milk a cow, was bitten on the leg by a serpent, influenced by time. Sarp, a serpent. This is the way of dragging a sincere soul nearer to God, the poor boy who's being looked after only by his affectionate mother. Yet the mother was taken from the world by the supreme world will in order to put him completely at the mercy of the Lord. So that was his only material shelter, was the affection of his mother. She couldn't even properly maintain, but at least she cared for him. And then it's taken from him. And this is so directly the hand of God in a person with the spiritual maturity of Narada, because he has enough faith then to only has God as shelter. And there's no illusion to think that anything else is really giving us shelter. That God is the ultimate shelter. And Prabhupada sometimes talks of material protective agents, that we think we have so many material protective agents. But they're all designed to fail. Because they're not a real shelter. Because they themselves are dependent on other things. So a real shelter has to be of substance. It has to be eternal. Otherwise, it's not going to provide shelter. It's only going to be temporary. So it's not a real shelter. A real shelter has to be eternal and substantial, and that's God. So ultimately, you have to take full shelter of God. Because that's the only real resting place for our affection. Because otherwise, we're loving things. But if we don't see the connection with God, then we're loving things that are actually superficial. We don't see the connection with God because, one, they're temporary. And two, they're not the real thing. The real thing is God and the soul, which is part of God. The body is the illusion of the self. It's not a real person. So if you don't really connect on a deeper level, that's not a real shelter. This is bhakti, when you actually have that faith that God is really the shelter. And sometimes you can't get that faith until every other thing that's actually false and temporary is taken from you. Otherwise, when you get an anxiety, some real angst, some real distress, what do you do? That's what you see as your shelter. Do you go to the refrigerator and eat? Do you look for sex life? Do you surf the internet? Do you go to your mother? What is your real shelter? What do you feel is your shelter? For a devotee, it's God. For everyone, it's ultimately God. So sometimes, this is, you know, he says a sincere soul And sometimes God makes a kind of a Krishna karmic arrangement. I'm sure the mother went to this incredibly better destination to take away your material protective agents. And this whole story now is going to be how that actually leads to dependence on God. Because now what does he have to do? He has to go wander in the forest. He has no money. So who's going to protect him? He has no mother. Who's going to protect him? Who's going to shelter him? Who's going to feed him? And he goes and he sees it happens anyway. So he gets a sense, yes, it's God who's actually our maintainer. And that feeling and that sense of dependence to dwell awakens so much love in the heart. And that love is the real shelter. Most of our pain is in terms of relationships and being dissatisfied in them. And all our real happiness is finding those relationships that actually empower us. I took this as the special mercy of the Lord, who always desires benediction for his devotees, and so thinking I started for the north. Confidential devotees of the Lord see in every step the benedictory direction of the Lord. What is considered to be an odd or difficult moment in the mundane sense is accepted as special mercy of the Lord. Mundane prosperity is a kind of material fever. By the grace of the Lord, the temperature of this material fever is gradually diminished, and spiritual health is obtained step by step. I'm saying people misunderstand this. So, mundane prosperity is described as kind of like a fever. Interesting analogy. When you have a fever, it's a kind of fever if that makes us attached to the conception of enjoyment and control. When the world conforms to our desires, and we have the wealth and the opposite sex, and the fame and the position that we want, then it's described like a fever. And it's a symptom of ill health. It's not just of prosperity, but if it's a symptom of our attachment to these things, then that can push us into material consciousness. So, just as when someone is sick, the fever has to be brought down to deal with the condition, because it's consuming the body. So, in the same thing, the material situation may have to be brought down to weaken our attachments. Because when we're in the sphere of control and enjoyment, we want to stay there when our control and enjoyment is working. But when it goes against our will, then we don't want to play that game anymore. We look for some other satisfaction and happiness. And if you have an inkling of good association, then you seek out spiritual people. You go for spiritual solutions. I say to people, my life, at one point in my life, everything went against my way, my desires. Now it's moving towards my desires. Now it's conforming, because what are my desires? I want to spread Krishna consciousness. It's good. I want to bring people to Krishna consciousness. It's happening. I have the objectives. I wanted a community. I'm developing one. But because I'm practicing Krishna consciousness, I want to be equal in happiness and distress. Not just be equal in distress, but equal in happiness. Because I don't want to make that my happiness. I want to make my happiness love. And that doesn't that's not dependent on whether my mission is successful or not. So I want to be equal. I don't want to absorb. It's just like when you take a hot shower, you don't want to absorb yourself in the body, because if you absorb yourself in the body, then you'll feel the pains of the body more. So you want to be a little bit indifferent to absorbing yourself in sense gratification. A little bit indifferent, naturally. And he said, people misunderstand this. And how do they misunderstand it? Well, God is cruel. But he's not cruel. You just have the wrong standard of happiness. Things are not happiness. Consciousness is happiness. So you'd have the wrong, what's good or bad? Is winning the lottery good or bad? It could be very bad. It could make you miserable. It could put you in material consciousness. It can make you more attached to the world, which you will have to leave. Or it could be good, right? Or losing it could be good. Not having it could be good. I'm humble. I'm poor. I'm dependent. Or it can be bad. I have so much poverty, and I'm desiring, you know, so many things, and I'll cheat for it. So it's a different standard. So most people don't understand this because they think that mercy is something else besides love in our consciousness, and therefore when they see God take one thing or give one thing to someone, they're judging God. Is he merciful or not based on what he gives to you? God is merciful if I win the lottery tomorrow. And if I lose, he's not merciful. Merciful means kind, and kind means wanting people to do well. And wellness is a matter of consciousness. So God is merciful when sometimes he takes away things. Because it forces a person with any spiritual understanding to deal with the real source of happiness, which is one's consciousness. So Narada understood this immediately because he had that knowledge of the Bhagavatam. It probably was incredibly painful for him, but he didn't let his external misfortune define him. And therefore, he was able to read his destiny as God's mercy. You see, I'm going to speak about this on Tuesday. What's good and bad karma? It depends on your goal. You know, if you want to hang a picture frame, a hammer is good. If you want to stir some soup, it's bad. So it's not the thing; it's the thing in relationship to the goal. And if your goal is spiritual, then you'll have a completely different viewpoint of what's merciful and not. Maybe losing the position is merciful. Maybe bad reputation is merciful. Then you have to stay aloof from people. Who says what's good or bad? So we're thinking God's mercy in terms of material things. But that's not a proven fact, what his mercy is. For some person, good health may be mercy. For some person, bad health may be mercy. But anyway, Narada saw this as God's benediction, even though it was so dramatic for him. But he can see it as God's benediction. He left his home, and he started to wander and experience God's creation. Okay, I'm going to stop here. 1 second. Hi, Bo. Would anybody like to say hello or ask a question?
Yes. Hare Krishna Maharaj. Please accept my humble obeisances. All glories to Srila
Prabhupada.
I have two things, you know, if you have time, you know, of at least 1 minute.
Yes.
The one thing you told in the beginning, that we, for changing, we need a commitment. And I think, you know, all of the Sangha members, they have commitment to listen to you every Sunday. That's a real commitment. It's not
Thank
easy.
You. I do feel that. I feel that's, and I do feel transformation happens by that. Thank you.
And second thing, Maharaj, you know, I would like to send you the GBC book now, Srila Prabhupada, the Founder Acharya of ISKCON.
Okay.
That Rabindranath Prabhu has, you know, compiled after 4 years of work. Yeah, so
okay.
If you can send me by email your address.
Thank you very much. I will send you my email.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But anybody else have a question?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Hare Krishna Maharaj. Anand.
Hare Krishna. You have a question?
I do. I hope you can expand a little bit. I understand philosophically the point you were speaking about, that accepting whatever God gives to us is for, that's His mercy, because He knows better than us what we need. If you can spend a little bit, few minutes, and explain how our mental attitude, or how do we do it practically? Is it gratitude? Is it what they call acceptance? How, maybe demonstrate how a devotee can think when something difficult happens. It will help me a lot.
Well, what happens is if you generally, a reversal in life will give you some lesson. And that lesson will be a tool by which you can live at a higher level of consciousness. What to speak if you respond appropriately to that reversal, the tool that you get, the realization you get will even be deeper. So when you live like that, you get faith in destiny as the benediction of God. And ultimately, we're going to die and we're going to lose everything. So we think right now there's reversals. Everyone is being set up for the supreme reversal. Right down to our identities, our, you know, whatever we're attached to, our nationality, our identities, our families, our attachments, our likes, our dislikes, our everything. So with that experience of responding to our destiny or living out our destiny or looking back at our destiny, and especially responding with Dharma, especially with guidance, especially with surrender to God, and we get that fruit of our destiny, then when death is happening, we'll also be confident. We won't be fearful. We'll also see God's hand because of our faith, our experience. So I think there's nothing else we can do but, well, the thing we can do is get more knowledge, get more understanding, and apply it. And be a little bit reflective. And to change our faith from happiness is things to happiness is how we respond to things, what our consciousness is. And the more you go to the platform of happiness being consciousness, then you become, you transcend the dualities of happiness and distress. And now, does that help?
Yes, yes, Maharaj. Can I say maybe it's a cultivation of trust in our consciousness and in Krishna? Like all those experiences build up our trust? Is that the right way to say it?
I say that it will, generally for a devotee, it will increase our trust, either by seeing it through the eyes of knowledge now, or looking back and seeing what that experience brought us in Krishna consciousness. What component of lesson did I learn from it? But in that sense, everything in bhakti promotes our trust and faith.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay, thank you, Anand. Now, there were some other people that wanted to say hello. Can anybody else say hello?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Lee.
Who is this?
This is Lee.
Oh, Lee?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Lee, from Jersey. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. Friend. Wonderful. Anybody else like to say hello?
Haribo. Haribo. Chaitanya Priya.
Always a pleasure to hear from you. Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay.
Earlier in the class, you talked about the importance of faith in developing consciousness. And in the case of the example of Narada, he did not, he was a 5-year-old boy, as you said. He did not have any experience that would prepare him before the death of his mother. As you said, he was completely dependent on her to really see the importance of faith. So how does one develop the faith in order to really change and come to the realization that God is the real shelter? Because that seems to be the real problem for most people in the world. And even those that profess to have no interest or belief in God, that is what their critique rests on, that this faith is something that is, you know, nebulous.
Well, faith comes from hearing. So the only way people are going to develop faith that don't have it is by hearing. And they have to hear from people who do have faith and have realization so that the message can be presented to those people in a way that they see there is some source of knowledge and guidance and understanding. Now, not everybody may be at that platform, so it is kirtan. People hear kirtan and they experience something, or faith, or distribution of prasadam, or just the grinding of the material world loosens their faith in material enjoyment and loosens their faith in their own control. So, you know, I don't know which person we're speaking to, but there's ways for everyone to get faith.
Okay, so it's going to be basically what you're saying, an openness to hear from somebody else so that you can learn, or just the hard knocks of life is going to shake your faith in material life.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Wonderful. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I'm trying again to say hello.
Yeah. What a surprise.
Maharaj, you know, I have to say, you know, this lecture, you know, so many lectures, but, you know, once again, this lecture, I would say is like the manifestation of my heart in the form of sound, you know, like every syllable it was, you know. And so... So it's interesting to me that despite the fact that, you know, I, as we know, I'm a regular, and I do feel this way about your realizations and so on, you know, and still, despite all of that, you know, that somehow or other the inspiration for commitment seems to elude me. You know, so I was wondering what you would suggest, since like all of the above doesn't seem to
well,
be working.
I would put this way: you are committed. You're committed to hearing, that's for sure. You're committed to going to Krishna conscious events. You have committed in a certain way in our relationship, and now we have to personally talk about what are the obstacles to the further commitment and actually see what they are. And they may turn out to be some things that we can expose as perhaps psychological even, you know, and, you know, perhaps see them and see why. Because what I'm seeing is, in terms of your hearing, you're becoming more and more inspired. So we have to see, you know, there's the story of the boatman, you know, the story of the boatman that they're, you know, that story, they're rowing all night. When they get up,
yeah,
they wake up, they're in the same place. They sing. So it's not that, but I've seen you advance a lot. You know, but the deep commitment, and a lot of it has to do with your own sincerity. You don't take things cheaply either. But we have to just perhaps, and I've been thinking of it actually, I was just thinking that we definitely have to meet. We have to discuss this.
Okay, Maharaj. Thank you.
Okay. And I am determined that we will meet soon. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Bo Maharaj. It's Christy Greer in D.C. Oh, hi, Malati.
Oh, hi.
What? Wait, who said from D.C.?
It's Christy Freer.
Oh, Christy. Great. Thank you for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just wanted
Wonderful.
To say it was a really helpful message today, I think, particularly for me, to think about commitment in terms of looking at shelter and in looking at, you know, where in our lives do we take shelter? You know, someone who's relatively new to the path, or I think for someone who's been on the path for a while, that's the easiest point in time to see where your commitment lies and where you may, you know, where we may need to make changes. I thought it was a really helpful focus point, so I appreciate you giving that to us today.
Well, thank you for reiterating it in a very lucid way. Thank you. Good. Malati, you're on today too?
Yes, sir. I will.
Okay, good. Thank you. Good.
And I agree with everyone else, the concept of commitment. Even this morning during meditation, that came up to me. I'm just so amazed that that was what your class centered on. I was thinking about discipline and commitment and, you know, yeah, it was a great class, a lot to think about.
Thank you. You see, I also think that it's the core point is surrender. And our lack of surrender is why we're in the body and why we're in the mind and what, you know. So when you actually get down to anything in a spiritual process, when you actually get down to it in a spiritual process, it comes down to that surrender, which means, you know, kind of a commitment to something beyond your whims, beyond your independence, your enjoyment and control, etc. And it is a scary thing for the materialist. For the materialist within us, it's a scary thing. You know, on one platform. And the other thing is the fear of exploitation. So for that reason, you know, surrender is from those two points. One, from the standpoint that, well, I will have to give up things that I'm attached to. And two, is the object of my surrender worthy? So from those two platforms, it's a crucial point. I know in my own chanting, you know, when I really get serious, especially in Kartik, when I'm up here, when I'm chanting a lot and chanting a lot, and then it comes to the point of your spiritual evolution and the point of let me go deeper. And there's the fear. Because what will it mean if I surrender to Krishna? What will it mean if I surrender to Krishna? What will that look like? Will it look like the world I want according to my desires that I'm maintaining and controlling? Will it look like that? So yes, it's the core material problem that we're trying to address. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Henry.
This is Henry.
Thank you.
Yes.
Great. Good. It's fun. You know, it's interesting. It may be just the time, but it's all people on the East Coast. We went right from, you know, New York to New Jersey to Delaware to D.C. It's all the same. No, actually, Chaitanya Kriya, she's out there in Portland. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
I just met John. You're
What's that?
I just met John last night. Your disciple.
Oh, where'd you meet him?
At the temple last night. We just moved into a temple, and he was there.
Okay. You ever met him before?
His whole family. Pardon me?
Did you ever meet him before?
No, that's why I'm so excited. I walked over to him after the class was the celebration was over, and we were talking, and I was telling him how I met you in the New York temple. You were my first teacher. You were so honest and open. I just wanted to hear more and more. And he, you know, was so excited because he was just agreeing, yeah, that's him, that's him. And he's coming back for Janmashtami next week.
Okay, great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
John, the car that I have, which now has 190,000 miles, it had 40,000 miles, that was purchased for me by him. I may have that car for maybe 10 years. So I put 140,000 miles on it, just driving and, you know, going around. But I'll just tell you my favorite John story. You know, he's from a pure Italian family from both sides. And, you know, he's kind of a hardworking guy. He's a pretty established systems engineer. He's got a really good work ethic. And, you know, even then he bought another place. He had one or two houses. And so he was moving into this new place and we wanted to inaugurate a program. And he said, you know, I said, well, I got an idea how we can get the maximum amount of people to come and bless your house. He said, what? I said, we'll call it. I said, bring your mother over, right? Because he likes to cook too. John loves to cook. All Italians like to cook. So we said, we'll make it the mother of all Italian feast festivals. And that place was packed. So I remember that. Yeah, anyway, and no, it's nice you met him. Very, very nice man, very nice wife, beautiful son. Great. Okay, thank you. Yeah, anyone else like to say hello? Somehow or other, I did. It's too late, but I didn't speak about Balaram. But it is Balaram Purnima. I'll just say, Lord Balaram serves Krishna in all affairs of existence and knowledge. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His first expansion is Balaram. The only difference is in color. And Krishna just enjoys, and in his expansion of Balaram, he manifests all the incarnations, including Guru Tattva. Guru Tattva is the potency of Balaram to increase the service of Krishna through knowledge. And Balaram serves Krishna in all five relationships, even manifests as Radharani's younger sister, Nanga Manjari. So it was wonderful. And Balaram are the presiding deities of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. Prabhupada established them in Gornitai. She wanted to show that Gornitai was not different than Krishna Balaram. And because a spiritual movement needs strength, and Balaram is the source of all strength. So, Balaram Purnima, very auspicious day. Okay, I really appreciate everyone coming on and listening, and thank you all. And anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Atmananda.
Atmananda, Hare Krishna. Good. Good. It's nice having new people come from different places. Amananda is in North Carolina. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who's this?
Gordon.
Hey, Gordon. We'll see you next Saturday if you're free. Or Friday at the Bhakti Center, we're going to have next Friday, we're going to have that our Lotus Festival in preparation for Janmashtami. And then on Sunday, up at my place here, we're going to have Janmashtami. We generally have a really nice Janmashtami festival here. I'll be in New York, but then I'll come up, and we'll have some really good kirtaneers coming. Shruti Ram and Ishri. Shri, and there's a really nice person called Adam Bauer, Kaylee told me he's coming. Plus some, of course, Satshrut Maharaj will be here, and a very special guest, but I won't say, because if I say who the guest is, we may be overcrowded. But anyway, good, good. Anybody else like to come? Say hello? Okay, well then, what a wonderful Sangha today. And it always happens when I think my realizations are the least, people appreciate them the most. Okay, thank you.